everyone. So I'm back with another haul from Forever 21. And actually, in my last haul video, I talked about how I didn't want to do hauls anymore, and I might only do a few just because it kind of feels like bragging, like, ooh, look what I bought. But then I had so many people that kind of put it into perspective for me, saying that they really enjoyed the hauls and they were my true subscribers and my true fans, and that why should I not do it for them because of the haters that could just turn the video off, whereas if I don't put the video up, they can't just watch it like the other people can't.
Okay, so I am here with Elizabeth Klein, who is most recently the author of Overdressed. Elizabeth, how are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Thanks for eating the cookies here. That's very appreciated, you know.
Great cookies. Great cookies.
So let's get right into business. So the disposability of clothes has become so firmly entrenched in our culture that when you visited the Quincy Street Salvation Army, you discovered that they were not only taking in dresses that still had their price tags on, but that the leftover material and the leftover clothing that is sold, it often gets thrown away, gets discarded for the leftover material costs. So, you know, a good, perhaps, question to start with is, how did we get to this point where fashion shares the problematic qualities of, oh, say, non-biodegradable plastic, especially since you point out later in the book that fast fashion industries are eyeballing China, which would, of course, add an additional strain to the environment. So why can't we see through this charming allure unless, of course, we're just driven to self-destruction?
Okay, you covered a lot of territory there. So I want to go back to how we got to this place. And I think that there are a lot of similarities to the food industry.
Yes.
The fashion industry today is extremely consolidated. It's corporate. And these corporations and companies operate by selling high volumes of product for very low prices. So, you know, a company like Forever 21 will put a very, very small markup on something they're selling, and they'll then sell hundreds of millions of garments a year.
So it's fast food, fast fashion. Why are we so accustomed to this particular Veblenian consumption? Why more now than ever? We've just, we're all victims of the marketing mechanisms, or don't we have any free choice?
Well, I mean, now we've sort of shopped our way out of an option. You know, going back 20 or 30 years ago, there were still independent department stores that sold a greater variety of price points. And because of markdowns and discounting and cheapskating consumers, that variety in the retail landscape is gone. So now if you're out shopping, your options really are super cheap or super high end. In terms of why we have gotten so quickly hooked on buying a lot, I think that just has to do with the psychology of cheap, and that just is a basic principle of consumer psychology. If something drops below a certain price point, it's pretty hard to resist. So if you're in a store and you see a dress for $10, your brain is just going to think, why not? What, there are no consequences for me financially, so I'm just going to buy it.
Yeah. Well, I must confess, I'm a guy, as you see, I'm wearing a funny t-shirt. Most of my expendable income goes, as you can see, also goes into books and maybe scotch. So, mm-hmm. You know, the haul video phenomenon that you write in the early part of this book was relatively new to me. I had actually not known. I was stunned to come across haul video
world.
The tutorials to make haul video. I was amazed by this. So, you know, you have these videos where these young women, they're boasting about their swag from places like Forever 21.
Yeah.
It's as if these young women, they don't understand that they are victims of marketing. They are, as you say earlier here, they just open their eyes and they go ahead and grab it. And if it's like less than $20, why not buy it? So, you know, the question I have is, you know, why can't these women see that they're victims of, you know, the behavioral economics that Dan Ariely has written?
I wouldn't say that we're victims of this per se. I think that we, you know, I'm going to give people, actually put a little more blame on consumers and say that we know what we're doing to a certain degree. And I think that what is more interesting to me about it is that it's, okay, so you buy something in the store and that deal feels really good. Mm-hmm. But for most of us, most women and certainly plenty of men, most of us don't really like our clothing. We're really frustrated with the things that we own. They either don't fit or they fall apart, or we feel like we're wearing the same thing that everyone else is wearing.
Do you like the clothes that you're wearing right now?
Yeah, I do. I do. And that, and it took me a long time to get to that place. You know, the stuff that I used to own was like very trendy and very cheap. And I just remember always feeling like, ah, I hate, you know, I'd get it home and then be like, I hate all of it. I don't want to wear any of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, how did we get to this point? I guess to kind of, sorry, it was sort of interrupting your story and pinning the blame on you, suggesting you might, in fact, be a closet hall video maker. But I guess that's not the case.
Well, you have escaped the mechanism. I actually made a haul video when I first started this process.
Really?
I was like, oh, I should do a green haul to show people what some of the alternatives are. And I actually should watch one of the tutorials because I remember making it and being like, oh, that camera angle is horrible. Because the haulers are really good at what they do.
Yeah.
You know, but, I, you know, they're not... I just am very skeptical of this idea of being an expert consumer. It's like, what does that even really mean?
Yeah.
People used to know about fabric and sewing and the craftsmanship of garments. And now being an expert in fashion means you know what the latest trends are. And really, what skill does that take beyond going in a store and seeing what's on the rack?
Mm-hmm. So the question is what is the appeal of making a haul video? Is it fame? I actually watched a good number of them because, again, it was a new phenomenon, and I was rather amazed that most of these young ladies were basically saying, well, come to my social media page, become a follower for me on Twitter or Facebook and so forth. I mean, is it mm-hmm. fame that they seek? Is it a form of self-expression? Is this replace the sort of previous iteration that we saw with Sex and the City? Why, above all, is it based around this idea of cheap? Why can't these women see that, really, it's a matter of actually accumulative purchases, $20 here, $20 there. If you add it up, compare that to, say, a durable dress that actually is going to last a long time, well, you're going to get probably more out of that, perhaps, down the long run.
Well, I mean, it's not, it's the idea of wanting quantity over quality. I think the appeal of that is pretty obvious, and hauls would not exist if fashion weren't cheap, because otherwise you would have this video where you were like, last year I bought this one dress and this year I bought these two pairs of pants. It would be really boring.
Yeah.
So the whole thing has to do with overconsumption. And the reason why these women can't see what they're doing is they grew up with this.
Yeah.
Fast fashion has been part of their reality since they were very young, and they, you know, these retailers aren't telling them that there's anything quote unquote wrong with what they're doing. And for them, they see it as a sort of expertise. Like, there, a lot of them are really good stylists. You know, I'm not gonna critique where the haulers are coming from. I think that this is something that we all do on some level.
Mm-hmm.
Even people who don't accumulate a lot of clothes are suckers for buying really cheap things now and then just having them fall apart or having them sit in the back of their closet.
Well, you would know more than me. I mean, you know, is there any kind of self-critical culture of like, wait a minute, the haul videos that we're making, maybe we're kind of giving in to the merchants and the manufacturers and the stylists and the fashion designers and so forth, we are essentially pawns in their hands. Is there any kind of serious critical culture like that among these? I mean, they're clearly having fun. I could see that. But I mean, I don't see them so much criticizing or even, you know, really analyzing what they do, except in relation to, well, should I make this type of haul video or that type of haul video? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, they, I don't know what type of I guess I would like to move the conversation in a different direction, because haulers are just one of, I mean, it's, we're all shopping this way. So, and why we haven't seen it up to this point is, it's, who knows, you know, I mean, it's because it's just, this has been slowly going on for the last 20 years, slowly happening. The retail industry changes, and you don't realize that your shopping habits are changing. I mean, that even happened in my own life. I used to be a diehard thrift store consumer 10 years ago and rarely ever bought anything in a store. And then 10 years later, I'm buying everything at H&M, Forever 21, Target, and Old Navy. So it's not like it happened overnight where people could be like, wait a minute, what are we doing? And then with haulers, those are mostly young women. So they grew up with this, and that's, I would say, why they haven't maybe turned a critical eye to it.
maybe another way to look at this is to analyze this through a interesting, well-spent common thread that you reference in the book, which I checked out. There's this dialogue between this fashion designer, Eunice Lee. She makes chinos and various other things here in New York. And then she gets into it in this common thread with a number of consumers who didn't understand why they were paying $228 for a pair of chinos. You have Lee replying, "You..."
Yeah.
Y-O-U, all caps. "The consumer has chosen. You have chosen to buy cheaper, and companies have listened!" Exclamation mark. "They move their production offshore. When you have so little manufacturing left in the USA, there are fewer factories who can actually negotiate prices with. But as you also point out in the book, you know, the mannequins of the past, well, they were wearing clothes that had finer threads than anything that we wear today. Short of becoming our own tailors, a vocation that is also fraught with difficulties and a need to become expertise, well, you know, what is the solution here? We don't have a manufacturing base. And do we blame the consumer of today or the consumer of yesteryear? The girls, as you say, who grew up into young women who made haul videos and so forth. That's why I'm stuck on the question."
Well, going back to the issue of domestic manufacturing, I think what's so interesting about that is that it's actually not really any more expensive to produce in the U.S. now than it was 40 years ago, and that's because of this really intense global competition. What's changed is consumers' price expectations. Now, a $200 dress is considered high-end, whereas that was quite a common price, and I'm adjusting for inflation. And of course, there was a huge difference in quality for a variety of reasons. And people don't make a connection between buying cheap imported goods and the loss of jobs in the U.S. And we really, really need to start making that connection. Because I think the garment industry is like one really good example of where we've just handed away manufacturing jobs. Garment and textiles, those were two of the fastest dying industries in the last 10 years. And the job loss has just been dramatic. But we haven't completely given it away. There are still a lot of garment factories in New York.
Yes.
There's still quite a big industry in Los Angeles. And actually, as prices, the price of labor is starting to go up in China, and now people are starting to move some things back here.
Yeah.
The challenge will be shoes and knitwear, because those are items, knitwear meaning sweaters, because those are things that require special machinery that we have completely given away. But it's not a lost cause. These are, you know, pretty basic fundamental industries, and they're not hard to grow if there was consumer demand for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about some of these New York merchants. You bring up Dalma Dress. It's a New York factory that has managed to remain competitive in the import-friendly market. However, when you asked factory manager Michael De Palma why his gowns cost several thousands of dollars, he replied, "Labor is labor." He tabulates in the book $633 in costs on a dress, and that's only to get the dress made. That doesn't even account to pushing it in wholesale. So that puts these gowns very much into the luxury market. You also have garment factors like Dynotex in Greenpoint. Dynotex, it basically makes its revenue from selling small supplies on the high end. So, you know, the question is how do we find an acceptable compromise between, oh, say, a Dalma gown and a shoddy mass-produced item of clothing? I mean, the factories clearly aren't here in America. They're here in spurts in these very small niche boutique markets. You know, Levi's held out for as long as it could, and even it had to close its last factory in 2003. So, you know, where are we at in terms of finding any kind of, I suppose, sweet spot between the burgeoning manufacturing base that we had before and the reality of today, which is, okay, in spurts, perhaps some Chinese labor outpricing it and moving it back here, but for the most part, you're dealing with very high-end factory people here.
I wouldn't say it's all high-end. It has to do with how we've come to define high-end. Mm-hmm. Certainly that the dress shop that you mentioned, those are runway gowns.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there are factories like the Dynatex factory in Greenpoint that they do produce more of like a boutique line, but that would be something that would retail between, again, like $60 and $200.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a personally personally, I think that that's a reasonable price for something that's well made. And there are brands like J Brand Jeans. There's a lot of quote unquote premium denim that's produced in Los Angeles. And that's, you know, those are jeans that are priced between $1 and, you know, $300. But yes, the big mass market chains are going to have trouble if they try to move their volumes back here, because the factories that are left here, it's not so much that they're high end, they're small.
Yeah.
Chinese factories, there's like sometimes thousands of people working in them. And then I went to some factories in Los Angeles where there's like a dozen, yeah. You know? So yeah, I don't think we're ever going to be able to do what maybe some of these Chinese factories do, but I would argue that why would we want to? I mean, we've kind of taken this thing as far as we can in terms of, okay, yeah, okay, now we can buy huge gobs of cheap imported Chinese or wherever they're imported from clothes. But where has that gotten us?
Yeah. The question then is, where do we place the blame? Do we place it on what the consumer wants, where, you know, what Eunice was sort of identifying?
You need someone to blame.
No, well, you got to start with somewhere, and then we can actually, hey, that guy's the one, or that person's the one. And, then we can at least look at the problem, you know?
I, of course, in the book, I put the blame on the fashion industry, yeah. And it's interesting because if you talk to people who work at these companies, especially the designers, they're as frustrated as the consumer is.
Yeah.
It's like we're all on this, you know, this high speed train and no one knows how to get off. You know, and these companies, they have shareholders to appease, so they have to grow every year. That's another problem. But yeah, absolutely. In the book, I put the blame on these big fashion chains, these big corporations, like, you know, I mean, whether it's JCPenney or TJ Maxx or Target or Old Navy, they all, of course, are just focused on getting people to buy as much clothing as possible. And that's about making money. I mean, that's just, you know, business.
Well, this leads me to ask you, since we are going to go ahead and place the blame on the merchants or the,
sure,
or the people,
yeah,
who
I'm comfortable with that.
So you point out in the book that even budget fashion chains have a bottom line. In the fall of 2010, H&M issues this $4.95 pinstripe dress. This is one of several contributing factors that led H&M's profits to drop 18%. So what's interesting, though, and this is not in your book, is that H&M seems to be very much in denial that it's this system of low wages, inferior materials, and operating costs, which is unsustainable. In the BBC News article you quote in the end notes, H&M's chief executive Carl Johan Persson, he says, increasing interest rates, higher energy prices, and austerity measures in many economies have decreased consumer spending power. So, you know, again, why do these merchants ultimately pin the blame on the consumer like this? Can you think of any budget chain or any operation that, you know, is more realistic about the fact that there may in fact be some sort of Hubbard's peak to all this in fashion?
I think that that's very common in business to just say, oh, we're just giving the consumer what they want. But really the consumer just accepts whatever's in front of them. And I think that market forces have a tremendous influence over our lives. And that's why I wrote the book from the perspective that I did.
Yeah.
H&M, yeah, they do. That store is, I just heard that they are actually thinking about launching a high-end luxury line. I don't know if they'll do it, but I think that they are, and a lot of other retailers are twisting themselves into knots trying to figure out how they're going to keep this up. And one thing that they're doing, which is really, I think, really scary, is they're moving into the Chinese market.
Yes.
And you know what, the population there is 1.3 billion people, and they want to hook Chinese consumers on disposable fashion as well. And it's because they just have this thirst for growth, and the model that they're running on, which is, you know, small margins, high volume, it's like Americans, we love to shop, but we can only buy so much clothing. So now they're moving to China and trying to get Chinese consumers to do the same thing. And it's just really not sustainable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we had NAFTA. We had at one point the multi-fiber agreement. That expires. And of course, the multi-fiber agreement, which put limits on clothing exports from developing nations into industrialized countries, well, this is responsible for the massive influx of imports. So, 2005, the year the multi-fiber agreement expires, you have imports of Chinese cotton trousers increasing by not 150%, 1,500%.
Yep.
2006, a full-time median wage earner had lost $1,400 thanks to this globalization. So, you know, how do we get out of this? Do we issue more caps? You know, do we return to the multi-fiber agreement? The free market enthusiast is probably going to tell you, hey, well, look, if America wants Chinese cotton trousers, then by Jove, we'll give them Chinese cotton trousers. So, you know, what is your response to someone like that?
I mean, I think that that honestly is a subject for another book. How are we going to get out of the you know, the problems caused by globalization? That's the probably one of the biggest questions facing this country right now. I mean, my personal opinion is I could say let's reenact protectionist measures for the garment industry, and I don't know if that'll ever happen. I do think the government needs to support the garment trades, which means, you know, I got a little bit into this into the book, and I wish I would have had time to get into it more, but there are types of vouchers and funding for equipment that the government could be doing. The government could even be supporting municipal textile programs, and that has nothing to do with jobs, but there does need to be more coming out of Washington in terms of sort of recognizing that this is an issue. And I think that one of the reasons why the government is not as interested in the garment trades is because it's low wage work. But the reality is that you've got people on the bottom of the economic ladder now who either don't have work, or they've been pushed even into even lower paid work,
yeah.
Which is what you've seen across all manufacturing bases. People used to have factory jobs are now working in the service industry.
The unskilled labor market, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And garment workers, it's always been immigrants and poor people, and that's the way they've worked their way into the American economy, and there's not an alternative there for them anymore. And, you know, I wish I had a complete solution to how we're going to fix that, but that's, you know, the book lays out the problem and says, okay, this is something the fashion industry, in cahoots with the government, created. Consumers now have to take that information and demand some kind of change. And I put forth some alternatives in the book, but I hope that other people read the book and, you know, lobby government if that's what they want to do, or call these chains and say, hey, can you produce more of your lines in the U.S.? There's so many different ways to address the problem that it almost just, like, makes my head spin thinking about it.
Well, and spinning heads are welcome on this program. But I mean, you know...
It's happening now.
But how... I mean, do you have any absolute... What would be the most blatant truth that would get people to think, wow, this is a huge problem? This is something that we really need to stare directly in the face, because, I mean, you know, we live in a city, as you know, most recently, where our mayor is more concerned with banning soft drink sizes than actually, like, say, addressing, for example, or contributing to an understanding of problems like this, which are much larger in scope and probably affect people's lives all the more than, say, obesity or whatever that comes from a soft drink and so forth.
Yeah, I would say we've got a first lady who is running around bragging about the fact that she wears Target, and people applaud her for that.
Yeah.
And, you know, our garment industry declined. We made 50% of our clothes here in 1990, and now we make between 2 and 3%. So the fact that, you know, we have someone in office and we're clapping whenever they wear imported clothing, and then you've got this, you know, flip side reality of, like, giving away an entire industry, that to me is what is perhaps most shocking in this situation. I mean, there are all other kinds of consequences of cheap fashion, but for me, it's a lot of it comes down to what's happened to the economy. And I talk about in the book how the clothing industry is really a good economic indicator. It's like, if there's not a middle market in the fashion industry, that usually means that there's not a middle class in society. And we saw this in the 1920s as well. the ready-to-wear market was split between high-end and super cheap.
Yes.
So, and that's because there were really poor people and really rich people. Mm-hmm. So when you see the fashion industry without a middle market, that's usually a good sign that there's not a middle class. And the two are so tied together, it's kind of scary.
You were sort of chiding me earlier about seeking someone to point the finger at, but it seems to me that actually you're doing the same thing by saying, wow, we now celebrate the fact that Michelle Obama wears Target. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, only, you know, 15 years before, we would go ahead and point the finger and Kathy Lee Gifford and say, you complete hypocrite. You're going ahead and producing this clothing line, and these kids are just, you know, doing backbreaking labor to provide you with your clothes. Obviously, we've advanced far along lines in a matter of 15 to 20 years. I guess we have to punish someone to actually solve the problem? Do we have to go ahead and find a scapegoat, or is there a more constructive, less vigilante mob way with which to encourage consumers to use whatever rights they still have to not opt for disposable clothing? Is it something along the lines of the slow clothing movement that you outline at the end of this book, or perhaps encouraging people, even people who are bad with sewing machines like myself, to actually go ahead and replace their particular clothes?
I mean, I think that people are in the spotlight, whether it's someone like Kate Middleton, who's always in the news because she wears the same thing twice in 10 days. You know, I think that does as much for, you know, the issues that I'm talking about as a book like mine does, just because she's such a high profile person. And Michelle Obama, the reason why I single her out is because her fashion has probably been the most talked about aspect of, you know, her reign, if you will, as first lady.
Yeah.
And people take their cues from her, and she is reinforcing this high-low dichotomy that we've got in the fashion industry now, which is like what you're supposed to do according to the fashion magazines is buy, you know, you have you splurge on your Louis Vuitton bag, but then you wear a Target dress, and that's American fashion.
Yeah.
That's considered American fashion now. And it's like, where is any of that made? And why did you overpay for a pocketbook, and why did you underpay for a dress? That's not helping anything.
Yeah. There's also one interesting thing I didn't really know about until I read your book, and that is this fascinating copyright problem in the fashion industry. I mean, it makes total sense once you lay it on the line that, of course, there have been spies with fashion shows, but we're dealing with an industry in which everybody copies everybody, and there is no absolute control over this. I mean, you know, you point out Ralph Lauren's quote that he owes his career to 45 years of copying. Mm-hmm. You know, there isn't copyright protection. Tom Ford, Guy Trebe even had to confess that there would be no fashion if you adopted Sandy Lane rules. Now, you have the internet today. You have high-def cameras that are instantly taking in any fashion show, any exposition. You have tailors on the ready to reproduce whatever it is that is being made somewhere else in the country. And that, to me, is absolutely fascinating. It's a magnificent counterfeit industry.
Yeah.
There were efforts to pass varying versions of the Design Piracy Prohibition Act. They didn't take, however. And what was interesting about that is that the bill's supporters, a few of them, were actually caught copying clothes made by independent designers. So I thought that was hilarious. So, you know, I'm wondering, are there any signs right now in 2012, it's been a while since you wrote the book, maybe about a year or so are there any signs now that this additional copying has had a drastic effect on the fashion industry, that it's actually becoming more of a problem, or are things relatively stable? And how does this compare in light of some of the globalization concerns we were just talking about?
I think copying is a problem because it feeds this, surplus of clothing. I mean, copying is what it's what creates trends, right? And trends sell fashion today. So it's like it just is enables this speeding up of the fashion industry. And so it's like, even if you're not copying exactly, if you're copying something almost exactly, that's, and every store does that, you know? And so that, like, this copyright protection bill that's moving through Congress is really only going to eliminate exact copies, exact replicas.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, and that should happen, but that's not going to really stop the fact that you can change, you know, a button or a stripe or something, and then that's totally fine. So, yeah, I mean, my whole point in bringing that up was that it's just like all of these retailers are looking at each other and copying each other, and just the system is just moving forward faster and faster and faster because of that.
But Elizabeth, the fashion information wants to be free.
It does. It does. You know, when I was in China, a lot of the factories there would, I would go into a sample room, which is where they have all of the designs that they've made hanging up on a rack, and they would take something off the rack and be like, do you want us to copy this? That's how easy it is.
Yeah.
And one time that happened, it was actually a Forever 21 garment.
Yeah.
Which I thought was hilarious. Like, I was like, okay, I'm being given the opportunity to rip off, like, the ultimate rip-off artist right now. Because I went undercover as a garment buyer. I guess I should have said that in the beginning. So they were trying to sell me designs. And it can happen on that level, but it can also be as easy as, like, someone in the U.S., like, in a design office, emailing a photo to the factory, and the factory just copies it there.
Yeah.
It's so easy to do now. And, you know, Forever 21 copying and these other companies, stores that copy designers, I think it's really mostly a threat right now to independent designers, as you were saying. You know, I really try to support independent designers, and they're having a hard time because, one, consumers think that their price point is too high because they don't understand the mechanisms of the fashion industry. But they're also like, why wouldn't I just go to Forever 21 and get it for $20 instead?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
We should really talk about some of what you observed in China, especially the labor exploitation and so forth. I mean, you say in the book that they had these facilities that they offered, and your impression was that they were showing you part of the whole drill whenever any American comes to visit. Do you feel that you got a sufficiently accurate idea of what was going on there? What do you feel is the takeaway labor-wise from what you saw?
I actually decided when I knew I was going to write the book that I wasn't going to write a sweatshop book because so many of them have been written, and I feel like people know more or less what's going on, that I didn't really have a whole lot to contribute to that story. I was really there to see how the business side operates, and absolutely I think I got an accurate reflection of what was happening, because there was no reason for them to hide those things from me. What I would say about the labor conditions is that the fashion industry has been in the spotlight now for almost 20 years for labor abuses overseas, and I mean domestically going back to 1911.
Yeah.
So the factories in China that I saw, and again, they knew I was an American, I'm sure I was shown the better factories, were clearly a product of a lot of, I guess I would say, cleanup.
Yeah.
Because of people are really afraid of getting busted for sweatshops now. So it's like, compared to American factories, the Chinese factories are very clean, very organized. They have the latest, machinery. All the fire exits are properly marked. There's fire extinguishers on the walls. Mm-hmm. So that kind of stuff is sort of like they've got their ducks in a row. And you can really tell that they've had to do that in order to do business with the West. I think instead of people looking for really extreme examples of human rights violations, they should concentrate on the wages being paid to these people.
Yeah.
And in the garment industry, that's poverty wages everywhere except for, you know, in the West. So to me, that's what's not acceptable. I mean, you can pay someone the minimum wage in China, and that's a poverty wage, and that's perfectly legal. That's not would not be considered a sweatshop story, but I mean that's the reality.
So how do we get some of these young women who make these haul videos to understand that there is tremendous poverty attached to what they get to enjoy at an H&M or any one of these particular stores?
I would like to think that people, especially people, you know, of the generation behind me, I'm 31, a lot of them are already, you know, I guess, conscientious consumers that care about the environment and they care about human rights. But it's like they need to be given a way to vote with their dollars. Like, for example, if, you know, H&M had a fair trade section or a living wage tag on some of their clothes, I think that they would support that. So I think that, you know, hopefully a book like mine and more stories will come out, and they'll start to say, go to these retailers and be like, hey, I like the designs, I want to keep shopping here, but you guys have really got to do more to earn my loyalty.
The other thing, and I'm going to bring this conversation to a close, but I am fascinated by the idea that everything has become more disposable.
Yeah.
That it's a matter of buying something, it's not going to last, and it's going to be thrown away. And we were alluding earlier that one of the solutions to this is, you know, encouraging people to sew, to fix up their footwear, to fix up their clothes. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I look at something like that and I say to myself, well, aside from the fact that, you know, re-sewing a button for me is something equivalent to Euclidean geometry, you know, I can do it, but it takes a long time. You know, there's also the time factor. Like, you know, if I want to go ahead and fix up a clothes, let's say that's 10 hours of my time. If I value my time at $15 an hour, that's, you know, $150. I could easily go to a store and instantly pay less for my time. What fundamentally needs to change in order to get us into this durability mode? Is there any kind of natural place for us to stop, short of, like, you know, all of us wearing like cardboard clothes or something, or like stuff that's gonna like be made out of paper that's gonna fall apart? I guess the no iron shirts would be kind of close to that, right?
I know, it's amazing how everything's like wrinkle free and just like you don't have to do anything; it's just bionic at this point. But sewing is definitely not about, you know, it's not about saving yourself time or even really about durability. People are getting back into sewing because it's satisfying, it's not for everyone, but the people who do it love it because it's just a way to like connect with your clothes. And I mean, we live our lives in clothes, so I don't think it's that surprising that people are looking for a way to interact with it in a more satisfying or meaningful way.
Yeah.
And sewing is one way to do that. And I certainly don't make, I do not have the skill to, I will never be able to make most of what I wear, but I do enjoy being able to alter and, you know, tailor the things that I wear and customize the things that I wear. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing to expect more people to get into, just because it feels good and it makes you like your clothes better. It honestly does.
So what we really need is an army of fashion alterers to go around and knock on people's doors and say, are you happy with your clothes? We can alter these clothes to actually fit you for a small, modest fee. And then people realize, oh, I like these clothes better. Maybe this is part of the solution. Maybe this is the way of durability.
I know.
I think we have an idea here.
I know. I just found out about a traveling seamstress in Williamsburg. I was like, thank
really?
You. Because I'm really lazy. Come to my house and fix everything I own.
Yeah, so we have to bring the seamstresses and the tailors. It'll be like, you know, I guess the old doctors used to show up to your home for in-house appointments. I guess this is the way to do it.
Maybe that's what I'm going to spend. That'll be my next career move. But yeah, that would be a great idea. I would love that if someone would just come to my house and go to my whole closet and, you know, make it work.
You have to fight convenience with convenience, I suppose.
Yeah.
All right. Well, on that note, Elizabeth, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Thank you for
fantastic.
Listening.
Nobody said very much. Just some old wild shirts and a couple pairs of pants which nobody really wanted to touch. Mama come in and picked up a book and Papa asked her what it was. Someone else asked, what do you care? Papa said, well, just be